Good evening. This is the KRFP Evening Report for Monday, October 1st, 2012. In the news tonight, U.S. Supreme Court upholds Clinton Forest Service roadless rule. Idaho Medicaid expansion working group meets. Gritman announces it will end adult day health program. And Washington State University student is in the hospital after a three-story fall. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The U.S. Supreme Court today decided it will not hear arguments in an appeal of the Clinton-era National Forest Roadless Rule, which initially protected 58.5 million acres of Forest Service land, mostly in the West, from logging and mineral extraction. The rule was signed by President Clinton during his last week in office in January 2001 and has been in litigation ever since. The appeal was filed by the Colorado State Mining Association and the state of Wyoming on behalf of mining and ranching and motorized vehicle users. Colorado Mining Association President Stuart Sanderson told KUNC Radio in Colorado that he's disappointed with the ruling, but said he was happy that the ruling will not affect Colorado's state-specific federal roadless rule, which, like Idaho's, includes exemptions for some road building in some areas that would have been designated as roadless under the nationwide roadless rule. The Idaho and Colorado roadless rules were part of a Bush administration alternative to the Clinton roadless plan. Pew Environmental Group Director Jane Danowitz said the Supreme Court action validates arguably one of the most important public land conservation policies in a generation. Without the roadless rule and its national standard of protection, these millions of acres of pristine forest land could be open to a variety of development, including logging, mining, and drilling. I spoke with Tim Presso of the national environmental law firm Earth Justice from his office in Bozeman, Montana.
The Forest Service in the 1980s prepared an inventory of all of its remaining roadless areas, and that inventory continues to be the touchstone for definition of what is roadless today. The inventory as of 2000 was about 58.5 million acres, of which since the inventory was done, roads had been developed on about 2 million acres out of that 58.5. The roadless rule dealt with that by saying we're going to protect the remaining roadless areas from road building and logging, but where roads have been created since the last inventory, it's going to be okay to continue to use those roads and log from them in areas that had been already altered by that past development. And in terms of the acreage, we talked about 58.5 million. 58.5 million was the acreage that was affected by the roadless rule as of its promulgation and at the end of the Clinton administration. But since then, the state of Idaho has had its own roadless rule promulgated by the Forest Service. That affected 9.3 million acres. So that's deducted from the 58.5, and Idaho's roadless areas are now subject to the Idaho-specific rule, not the national roadless rule. And more recently, Colorado developed its own roadless rule, which is 4.6 million acres. So all totaled, there have been approximately 15 million subtracted from that 58.5 in terms of what the roadless rule affects today.
I see. And I understand the Idaho specific federal rule was part of an alternative to the roadless rule put forward by the Bush administration. Can other states still go for that, where the governor or the state government puts together their own roadless plan, or is that window closed now?
Under the federal law, a state can always petition the U.S. Agriculture Department for a specific rule, and it's certainly open to any state to make that kind of petition. I should say that, you know, we certainly don't support those kinds of petitions. because these are, our position is these are national lands that should be subject to national management. They're not state lands that should be subject to management that's desired by any specific state. So I just want to be clear that I don't want anybody to take my comment to suggest that we'd favor those kind of state-specific proposals, but the law permits them.
Okay, and how might the land or ecosystems be at a disadvantage if a state went forward with one of these specific systems?
Yeah, well, let's look at the Idaho rule as a great example, because we have opposed the Idaho rule. And at the very beginning, the Idaho rule takes 400,000 acres of roadless areas and removes all regulatory protection from them. So while the 2001 roadless rule protected those areas from new road building and logging, the Idaho rule lifts that protection entirely and subjects them to whatever road building and logging would otherwise be allowed under the existing forest plan. So there's 400,000 acres of roadless areas that are essentially thrown out by the Idaho rule off the bat. And then with respect to the remainder in the state of Idaho, the great bulk is within a classification that has additional loopholes, new loopholes for road building and logging, some of which is characterized as fire prevention activity. And the problem with that is that it doesn't just deal with fire prevention around developed areas where you've got people's houses and property at stake. It talks about road building and logging deep in the backcountry under the guise of fire prevention. And number one, we don't think there's any scientific support for that. But number two, when you're talking about protecting roadless areas, if you're logging the backcountry and under the excuse of fire prevention, you're not providing much protection.
So what was the opposition arguing, the state of Wyoming and the Colorado Association?
Yeah, their principal argument was that they believed that the roadless rule created wilderness areas effectively by leaving lands roadless, and they said only Congress can create wilderness areas under the 1964 Wilderness Act. And of course, the roadless rule was an act of the Forest Service, not an act of Congress. The problem with that argument is that roadless areas are not equivalent to wilderness areas. The roadless rule prohibits road building and logging, but the Wilderness Act prohibits not only road building and logging, but also any motorized vehicle, any mechanized vehicle, such as a mountain bike, any commercial activity. So, for example, you can ride your off-road vehicle in a roadless area, and the roadless rule doesn't care about it. But if you ride your off-road vehicle in a wilderness area, you're probably going to get a citation from the Forest Service.
Mm-hmm. And so these roadless areas are not managed the same as wilderness, although there can be some similarities if the Forest Service on a local basis wants to make the travel plan more restrictive because it's a sensitive area, right?
That's true. But, of course, that can happen regardless of the roadless rule. There are plenty of areas in the National Forest where the Forest Service, through forest plans, has applied protections, and that really didn't have much to do with the roadless rule. Our point to the Supreme Court, which prevailed today, was that the lower court got it right in finding that roadless areas under the roadless rule are not equivalent to wilderness areas under the Wilderness Act, and therefore there was no Wilderness Act violation.
Okay, and finally I want to ask, for those of us who are might be concerned about the impact of wild lands on sensitive ecosystems, and particularly ecosystems that might be sensitive to climate change, what is the significance of upholding the Clinton-era roadless rule?
Well, I think you put your finger on an extremely important point. If we're talking about Idaho, if we look at the kind of the huge salmon selway ecosystem in central Idaho, there are large designated wilderness cores, but there's also a surrounding ring of inventoried roadless lands that were not designated wilderness and would be subject to roading and logging development but for the roadless rule. Similar situation exists around the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, Yellowstone National Park and its surrounding lands, and also the Crown of the Continent ecosystem, the Glacier National Park, Bob Marshall Wilderness Complex in northern Montana. In each of those situations, you've got roadless areas providing key parts of the ecosystem and the connective tissue between national parks and wilderness areas. And when we talk about a changing climate, you're talking about species of both plant and animal species having to adapt to a whole range of different conditions. And the way that they adapt frequently is by moving either to further north, moving higher up slope, whatever the case may be. And so, you know, in order to preserve these species, you need the largest possible landscape upon which they can make those movements, so that if you're an animal species that needs to move further north to survive, but you're looking at running a gauntlet of eroded lands with all kinds of disturbance to get there, you're going to have a much more difficult time than if you've got a roadless corridor that allows you to make that movement. And I think scientists are pretty unified in their view that it's really important to preserve these remaining roadless areas to provide both wildlife and plant species with their best possible opportunity to survive the changes that are coming. And this summer was a good indication of what scientists tell us the future looks like: hotter, drier, longer, warm season, and roadless areas that continue to provide undisturbed habitat, clean water, refuge for wildlife become more and more important as those conditions start to become the new norm.
That was Tim Presso of the environmental law firm Earth Justice speaking to KRFP this afternoon from his office in Bozeman. You're tuned into the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP in Moscow. To get further perspective on today's U.S. Supreme Court decision on the Clinton-era National Forest roadless rule, I spoke to Brett Haverstick of the Moscow-based environmental group Friends of the Clearwater.
Today's a great day for all Americans and all of America's wildlands. The United States Supreme Court did the right thing today by honoring the sentiment of the majority of Americans, and that is keeping the 50-plus million acres of roadless wildlands just that, roadless and wild.
What criteria makes land roadless and thus part of the 58.5 million designated acres?
Despite the obvious fact that roadless lands do not have any roads and or are undeveloped, the main criteria when looking at roadless lands and whether or not they qualify for future wilderness designation is they've got to be 5,000 acres or larger. So generally, they're large blocks of federal public lands that are roadless and undeveloped and still truly wild.
Is a lot of this rock and ice, or is there a lot of ecosystems that maybe are sensitive to climate change?
That's a great question, and it really gets at the crux of this conservation battle. While there is a mixture of low elevation and quote, rocks and ice as part of the roadless lands, you know, that are in question here, a large part or a certain percentage of these roadless lands are crucial low elevation roadless lands important for wildlife and fisheries habitat.
So this Supreme Court decision is pretty much applicable everywhere except Idaho, is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. Sad but true. While the rest of America can rejoice, and rightfully so, unfortunately, Idaho has its own Idaho roadless rule, which is still in the court system, and that's going to take a little more time to play out.
And this Idaho roadless rule is a federal rule that was put in place as an alternative to the Clinton roadless rule. I guess we could call it the Bush roadless rule, where the governments and governors of the specific states put together their roadless plans, and Idaho's the only state that took advantage of it. Is that how it worked?
That's a good explanation on your part. Colorado would be the second state that didn't get as far along in the process as Idaho did, but still was given the leeway to develop their own roadless rule.
That was Brett Haverstick of the Moscow-based Friends of the Clearwater commenting on the U.S. Supreme Court's decision today to uphold the Clinton-era National Forest Roadless Rule, which initially protected 58.5 million acres of Forest Service land from logging and mineral extraction. Haverstick says certain roadless areas do allow motorcycles and mountain bikes, which are not allowed in wilderness areas, which forbid mechanized travel. Turning to other news, a former Nampa school superintendent has sued the state of Idaho and all school districts around the state because he says the governments are violating the state constitution because they are more frequently charging fees for students. Russ Jokey says his grandson was charged $85 to enroll in Meridian High School, and his twin granddaughters were charged $45 each to enroll in kindergarten. Jokey is seeking class action status to represent all parents of school children and all school children statewide in 4th District Court in Ada County. There are 18 plaintiffs in the case right now, including 15 grandparents of Idaho public school students. Jokey is arguing the state constitution calls for free common schools. Jokey told the Spokesman Review website after filing the lawsuit this afternoon, "It's at a time of great public debate on schools and great economic stress on families." He said schools statewide are increasingly giving students lists of school supplies that parents need to purchase, such as specific brands of colored pencils, types of paper, and dry erase markers. Jokey said these supply lists are a substitute for essential educational materials that the district needs to provide. Instead, the burden has been placed on parents and patrons. The Environmental Protection Agency is proposing a system where 2/100,000 of an asbestos fiber per cubic centimeter of air would be designated as a health risk. If the rule is approved next year, the new standard would be 5,000 times more stringent than the current system, where 1/10 of a fiber per cubic centimeter is the health risk threshold. The Maryland-based W.R. Grayson Company, which is on the hook for years of contamination of factories where products using asbestos laced vermiculite from its mine near Libby, Montana, was processed, opposes the new standard. The company is not only paying for much of the $500 million cleanup in Libby, Montana, but also sites around the country where the particularly dangerous Libby vermiculite was processed and packaged. W.R. Grace Vice President Karen Ethier said the new standard would, quote, result in enormous, unexpected, and unnecessary costs to building owners, farmers, and other property holders, including the federal government. Former U.S. Surgeon General Richard Lehman told the Associated Press the proposed standards would be like banning asbestos because the thresholds would be so low. Lehman said, quote, EPA is being realistic and saying, look, we know there's asbestos out there and we're not going to get rid of it all, but let's put our concentration as low as we possibly can. A dry cold front could bring winds up to 35 miles per hour to the area tomorrow night, stirring up wildfires. Crews working on the Sheep Fire near Lucille along U.S. Highway 95 are working on fire lines in case the fire flares up again, but the fire is officially on mop-up status. Crews fighting the McGuire Complex east of Grangeville are constructing control lines on the east and southeast edges to prevent the fire from spreading to the Noble Creek drainage. The fire is 20% contained. Fire activity has subsided enough that residents traveling to the in-holding community of Dixie can now drive Forest Service Road 222 at any time of day without an escort vehicle. Mail service to Dixie was expected to resume today. 125 miles of hose was laid out near Whitewater Ranch along the Salmon River because of fire activity in the area. Fire Information Officer Aaron Heap McKenzie says the pumps are being cleaned and packaged for the next fire, and the hose was the equivalent of 7 to 10 semi-truck loads. Fire activity has subsided in central Washington as well, although larger fires have not been contained. Governor Chris Gregoire has extended the open burning ban for all areas east of the Cascades until next Sunday.
The Gritman Medical Center Board of Directors voted late last week to end the Adult Day Health Program at the end of the year, which gives elderly and infirmed people a place to go during the day, cutting down on home health caregivers. However, a press release from Gritman spokesperson Kelly O'Neill says Gritman has been losing $360,000 per year on the program that was supposed to be eventually funded through Medicaid reimbursements. That was the plan when the health program was started in 2001. Those reimbursements never materialized. Gritman board chair B.J. Swanson said this type of financial loss is unsustainable. To continue the program would jeopardize our ability to provide necessary core services for the entire community. Swanson added that the board has looked at options for continued funding over the years, but has not been able to find any. The Idaho Medicaid Expansion Working Group met last week to begin figuring out how that can be done. The panel, appointed by Governor C.L. Butch Otter, has three options: keeping things the way they are now, expanding Medicaid in Idaho to cover more low-income residents, while restructuring the county and state-funded medical indigency program, or expanding the federally funded Medicaid program and ending the medical indigency program. The medical indigency program costs $60 million per year, and the panel saw projections predicting the cost would rise to $92.2 million per year in Idaho by 2020. Idaho Association of Counties Executive Director Dan Chadwick said the indigency program is unsustainable. Idaho Medical Association CEO Susie Pouliot said physician members of her group voted to support expanding Medicaid in the state over the summer. Pouliot said expanding Medicaid would move Idaho to more of a managed care system. That, she says, would mean, quote, coordination and transitions are managed in a way that produces good health results. A 22-year-old Washington State University student was flown to a hospital in Spokane for treatment by a neurosurgeon after a three-story fall from a Pullman apartment balcony Friday night. Pullman Police Sergeant Dan Dornis told the Daily News the man was trying to climb from the second-floor balcony to a third-floor balcony of the Boulder Creek Apartments on Northeast Terreview Drive. Dornis said the man had been drinking. Other alcohol-related falls this semester at local universities include a 19-year-old University of Idaho student hospitalized after a 20-foot fall down a Taylor Avenue embankment August 23rd, a University of Idaho student seriously injured after falling from the roof of Alpha Tau Omega in the early morning hours of September 12th, and a 19-year-old Washington State University student injured falling from the third floor of the Phi Kappa Tau fraternity in Pullman, September 14th. Coeur d'Alene police shot and killed a 19-year-old Hayden man Saturday after the man allegedly shot a man in the back seat of a vehicle he was riding in, took over the driver's seat, and shot at police and other people on downtown Coeur d'Alene Street. Coeur d'Alene police identified the dead man as Christian Nicholas Bouquet. Witness Rick Noki told the Spokesman Review he saw a four-door vehicle stopped at an intersection in front of his apartment, and a man got out of the front passenger seat and shot twice at a man sitting in the back seat, hitting him in the chest. The victim and a woman then got out of the car and tried to hide. The shooter got into the driver's seat and drove away, firing shots at local residents, sending Noki running for cover. The shooter allegedly shot at police and other people as he drove away on Lakeside Avenue. He lost control of the car at Higgins Point and was killed by a shot from police. The man who was shot in the chest was identified as 29-year-old Frank James of Coeur d'Alene. James was taken to Kootenai Medical Center and underwent emergency surgery. There was no report of his condition yesterday. Coeur d'Alene police processed five separate crime scenes related to the shooting spree Saturday and Sunday. Washington officials and representatives of employee unions continued their negotiations over the weekend, but the State Office of Financial Management said Friday an agreement is unlikely by today's deadline. The state has tentatively agreed to reverse a 3% pay cut imposed 2 years ago. Most of the negotiations are over health care benefits for 60,000 state employees. 15 unions have reached agreements with the state over pay, and 10 more unions are in arbitration. Teamsters Local 117 is still negotiating over pay. The owners of Schweitzer Engineering Labs in Pullman have announced they will donate $310,000 to the city of Pullman to improve the Pullman Aquatic Center and Fitness Center, whose construction Ed and Beatrice Schweitzer paid for in 2000. The donation to the Pullman Aquatic and Fitness Center will also fund expanded hours of operation, which had been reduced due to City of Pullman budget cuts. Of the total, $250,000 will pay for a number of renovations, such as a boiler, heater, ventilation, and air conditioning improvements, supplemental air conditioning, resurfacing pool bottoms, installing more showers, and replacing weight equipment. $60,000 will pay for expanding operating hours. The Moscow City Council has a short regular agenda for tonight's meeting. The agenda includes an appeal of a taxi license denial for Denise James and a Citizens Commission report on the Moscow Arts Commission. The consent agenda is voted on as a whole towards the beginning of the meeting, with the stipulation that a single city council member can remove any item from the consent agenda and put it on the regular agenda. Tonight's consent agenda includes ratifying acceptance of the East City Park restroom design project, a memorandum of understanding with the Idaho Transportation Department Office of Highway Safety to accept $70,000 in grant money for an e-citation system for city police cars, a memorandum of understanding for the Moscow Police Department to participate in up to 11 traffic enforcement mobilization programs in which the Office of Highway Safety provides funding for the extra hours worked by police, retaining Lewis and Associates to audit the city's cable TV franchise with Time Warner, and a grant submission to the Idaho State Historical Society for a reconnaissance survey of the Fort Russell neighborhood. Tonight's city council meeting begins at 7 p.m. at City Hall. Well, that's it for the KRFP evening report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, it'll be mostly clear, low 48 tonight, sunny, high 67 tomorrow, and partly cloudy with a low 38 Tuesday night with northwest winds 10 to 15, gusts up to 30 miles an hour. Mostly sunny days through the rest of the week, highs around 60. Currently, we have 70 degrees under fair skies in Moscow. We've got the Eat the Airwaves, a truncated version, coming up next, and that'll be followed by Flashpoints, the daily investigative news magazine from Pacifica Radio. I'm Lee Robartis. Be sure to help KRFP by going to the KRFP website and becoming a member. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a good night. This is KRFP Moscow.